Welcome to Brain-Based Parenting, the Boys Ranch podcast for families. We all know how hard being a parent is, and sometimes it feels like there are no good answers to the difficult questions families have when their kids are struggling. Our goal each week will be to try and answer some of those tough questions utilizing the knowledge, experience, and professional training Cal Farley's Boys Ranch has to offer. Now here is your host, Cal Farley Staff Development Coordinator, Joshua Sprock.
Hello again, this is Joshua Sprock. Last week we started our series on brain development, and as we mentioned last time, our discussion proved to have much more depth than we realized. So today we will pick up where we left off by venturing into the next stage of brain development, the diencephalon. So get ready for part two as we talk about how our kids' brains develop. To do that, I'm joined today by Catherine Clay, our clinical supervisor.
Hello.
Chloe Hewitt, Assistant Administrator over Residential Communities.
Hi.
And Erica Hawkins-Burrell, our Clinical Intervention Specialist.
Hello.
All right, let's move on to the next area of development, which is the diencephalon. When is it formed and what functions does it regulate?
So formed between 0 to 3, in charge of regulating sleep, being alert, arousal, and appetite. And so that's, again, why we say 0 to 3 is so critical, because of 85% of it being developed, the brain being developed.
And movement, balance, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about kind of as we've watched our kids grow up.
Yeah.
During that period of learning what's stable, what's not stable, stuff like that.
Yeah, you really think about it. It's all the things that little kids in that time period are doing, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what role does the diencephalon play in early childhood development of a child's emotional regulation and social interactions then?
So, you know, I talked about that a minute ago. When the baby cries, you have to meet that need, whether it's hunger, just calming down, or dirty diaper. Like, you're meeting all of those needs for it. So you're truly relying on your parents to regulate you by rocking, helping them sleep, touch, all of those things.
Yeah, I always think of this as the trust part of the brain. When you meet those needs, when the baby cries and you meet those needs, they learn that their caregiver can be trusted to set that template of need meeting.
Well, and it makes sense, though, because I think if those needs are not met, this is kind of the result of that would be like affect symptoms, like affect depressive symptoms, stuff like that. So it makes sense to connect those two.
Yeah.
As a result of that not being met, I would bet.
Yeah, it always makes you think of the study, which, Josh, you'll probably have to point it out, but when the mom's in there and then leaves and then the reactions the babies have.
Oh, yeah, the strange situation.
Yes, okay. So
yeah. Google that if you want to. It's very fascinating.
It is.
And a little bit heartbreaking.
Yeah. It is heartbreaking. It's hard as a mom.
Yes.
So we talked about this being, you know, 0 to 3 and just seeing all the different things that 0 to 3 kids go through. What role does spatial awareness play in this part of the brain? So what about its role in spatial awareness and balance?
So the diencephalon also is where we're looking, where movement is developing. So, you know, we see kids crawling, we see them walking, and they're developing what's called proprioception, which is how they integrate their selves and their bodies into the physical world. And so their awareness of, which is still developing at this time and will continue to develop, but, you know, their awareness of how close they are to something, you know, depth perception, their ability to spin and not get dizzy or get dizzy, all of that's developing at that time.
And now that we're talking about it, I guess jumping's also a big one. Mm-hmm. I did not think that was a big one until I had kids, and then they were like, can he jump?
Or skip.
Yes.
Skip is another one.
And so recently at my 5-year-old's appointment, they had to make him stand on 1 foot balanced on both ones. And I thought, oh, I don't even know if he can do it. I've never watched him do it. So it is one.
Did he do it?
He did it. He did it.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So if they're struggling in areas like that, they're not able to balance, might that be a warning sign that there might be a deficit in that part of the development of the brain?
Yeah, and I think we see that quite a bit out here, actually, like the way that sometimes we'll notice the way they walk or the way that they even run. One of the kids specifically that I can think of, when he runs on the football, we know it's his by his run because it just looks a little different. So I do think we see that quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, and we ask about, like, when we were doing some of our work in the clinical department about the development of large motor skills, and that being in, like, lack of large motor skills or some kind of deficit or difference, kind of like what you've spoken to, Chloe, how that can lead backwards to this area of the brain having some type of insult to it or in some type of trauma. at that point. And so we see that in, like Chloe said, the gait and the walking. I think something I see a lot out here are kids that walk on the tips of their toes or have a very, their walk is very slow or uncoordinated, things like that.
Manifest. One thing I see a lot of times is kids who kind of have that walk you're talking about, and then maybe they bump into someone and then they either don't realize they bumped into someone or they have the overreactive response where it's a little cuckoo over the top.
And I think what's really endearing about kids at this age when their brain is developing at this time, like when their diencephalon is really coming online, is their bodies naturally are seeking out. Their bodies want to develop normally and their brains want to develop normally. So they're seeking out those activities. You know, they're hopping around, they're spinning, they're jumping, they're doing all the fun stuff that kids love to do.
Yeah.
It's so funny you say that because on Friday nights when we have football games here, there's like this little grassy area right by the football field that every child, it's like you have to be there, but every child between, I don't know, one or two and six or seven are constantly rolling around and flipping this way, flipping that way. And I remember asking a friend, like, why is my child always, nearly always upside down? She's almost always upside down.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of stuff. It's just interesting to put it in perspective.
And we are the most dysregulated as the parent watching all of them.
Absolutely.
But it sounds like it's something that's necessary and needed. So instead of, some people may be tempted to shut that type of behavior down, but maybe in certain circumstances it might be encouraged.
I think as long, like for me, it's, I let my kids do most things like that that look like horseplay or look like play as long as nobody's getting hurt, right? Because I know that they are meeting a sensory need at that point. And if it doesn't come out in this safe environment, for example, the football field, that little corner of grass where they're safe, it's going to come out in a way that is not helpful or ideal for us as parents. So I just try to honor what their body's needing at that moment. Can't always do it, but it's nice when we can.
So one of the things I think I've seen older kids struggle with is sensory integration. So could you guys talk about what role the diencephalon plays in sensory integration and why that's important?
The diencephalon's the, it's the integrative epicenter for the majority of any of our sensory motor and our even our limbic impulses. So as we've been talking about, our sensory input comes in through the brainstem, gets filtered through the brainstem, then the next place it goes in the is the diencephalon. And so when we're looking at sensory integration, the diencephalon is integrating that piece of information as well. So if we're looking at like proprioception, where we are in space, or just movement, what our body's doing, even our appetite, if we have like any hunger cues, that's going to relay information to the next parts of our brain.
So listening to music, playing with different textures, I hate slime with a passion. So that is like the one thing as a parent, I was like, you can do Play-Doh, you can do the kinetic sand, but I can't do slime just because it sticks on everything or silly putty, which was a big when we were kids. I don't know if it's as big now, but smelling the different smells, because my kids love bugs and they love to smell the bug. Like they love to do smell everything. And so, and recently, I'll talk a little bit, my five-year-old in his class just did a taste example, which I thought was the coolest thing. So they picked out something sour, something sweet, something bitter. So he comes home yesterday and he's like, I don't like the sour. And I was like, well, what was your sour? And he was like, it was a lemon, Mom. And it was so sour. And then the bitter they chose was a bitter chocolate because they thought the kids would love it, but they wanted to try a bitter. So it was neat. Like they talked to him about through it. And I thought that was really neat.
So how can providing a sensory rich environment impact positive development for kids?
I just keep thinking about, I went on a walk recently with a friend and her two-year-old, and this friend and I go on walks frequently, and this time she had her two-year-old with her, and he really wanted to walk. He wanted to get out of his stroller, and it was just so cool to, I mean, the walk took like twice as long, but he was picking up every little twig, and he was like, look, Mama, look at this, look at that, showing us all these new things. And so even something so simple as going for a walk and being outside to see it through a two-year-old's eyes or a really young child's eyes, there's so much that they're taking in, and they're really engaging all of their senses in that moment. It's like very cool to be able to have the time to pause and really look at that, because there's so much going on in their little brains at that moment.
Yeah, and I think it just, it gives the brain the ability to grow and change, really, ultimately. And I think it's providing that sensory rich environment is what will ultimately change and help the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder what the lack of a sensory rich environment might, what impact that might have on a brain.
Well, I think we said it a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. if that piece of the brain is not activated, it's kind of a use it or lose it situation, mm-hmm. in a way. And then I think you'll find if a kid has all the, I'm trying to think of how we see it here. So when we have kids here, usually we will begin to see, if there's sensory issues, we will begin to see behaviors, usually at school, where there's something that's too loud, the lights are too bright, mm-hmm. there's a certain smell or whatever, and they cannot stay mm-hmm. in this system, this school. And so we'll usually see increased, like, principals and teachers and whatever sending emails and whatnot. And so I think a hard thing to understand is when a kid is older, like an adolescent, and they're mm-hmm. still struggling with mm-hmm. these sensory things, that maybe we can accept a little bit better when it's coming from a little kid. And we have plenty of adolescents who are very sensory seeking and sensory avoidant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like Chloe, I think you were talking about, I don't know if you were talking about regulation, but same with sensory. It's so specific to each person.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's either I really like loose clothing, or I really like tight clothing, or I really like silky clothing. Or, I mean, there's so many caveats to sensory seeking mm-hmm. and avoidance. And I think that makes it really hard for people, teachers, whoever, parents, to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's always an area that I want to learn more about and be more educated about, because I think I see it in my own kids, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, it doesn't matter if you've had a hard history or you've developed typically, you mm-hmm. have said, every single person has sensory sensitivities,
mm-hmm. yeah.
seeks certain sensory input or avoids it. And it's not necessarily about having a trauma history or whatever yeah. you want to say. So I just think it's an interesting topic that maybe we don't talk about enough.
Yeah, I was real thankful our school here was sensitive to that. My youngest daughter in elementary school, she could not wear blue jeans at all. And there was a time out here when the dress code was you had to wear blue jeans. And thankfully, they changed that before she got into elementary school. But I don't know what she would have done. Like, her entire elementary school, she would have a meltdown anytime we'd have to do anything where...
That's wild.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My daughter calls jeans hard pants.
Yeah.
Because they are hard.
They are.
And so I'm thinking the same. It would be a power struggle every single mm-hmm. morning mm-hmm. trying to get my daughter in hard pants.
Yeah.
That's horrible. I don't want to wear hard pants.
No.
I was thinking, too, as we're talking about adolescents, because I think what we see is, too, if we're taking them for regulation drive. So if I get a kid and he's super upset or she thinking, okay, I'm going to try and regulate them, let's go on a drive. But giving them the power of, hey, you want to put your music on, mm-hmm. even though it's going to, you know, if you're calm and you're in a place, because some of them, it might be heavy metal, some of them, it might be country, it could be rap, it can be whatever they prefer, but them getting that sensory of this is the music I like, this is what I enjoy, mm-hmm. it's also helping with that regulation mm-hmm. and gives them power, because mm-hmm. as teenagers, we know they want that power.
All right, thank you for spending some time developing your brains with us today. Until next time, remember, you might have to loan out your frontal lobes today, just remember to make sure and get them back.
Thank you for listening to Brain-Based Parenting. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you would like more information about Cal Farley's Boys Ranch, are interested in employment, would like information about placing your child, or would like to help us help children by donating to our mission, please visit calfarley.org. You can find us on all social media platforms by searching for Cal Farley's. Thank you for spending your time with us, and have a blessed day.